Shohini, welcome to Brand Game Strong.
Thank you.
It's great to have you.
Great to be here.
Yeah.
Been an avid follower since day one.
Thank you. And I'm a follower of yours. And I just love your food. I love the taste of it. I've been to your supper clubs multiple times. I've been to your cooking lesson.
Yes.
Big fan over here.
Oh, thank you.
You're doing really, really well. I think it's just great to see your growth that a few of us have been witnessing over the past few years. Well, we're going to be talking about all things food and also heritage and your background, because I know you're very unabashedly Bengali. So should we start with that maybe? Do you want to tell me a little bit about what it is you do, what it is you are working on at the moment, what your brand's name is, and also a little bit about where you grew up and your roots?
Yeah, so I was born in Kolkata. My parents moved here when I was about 8/9. Mm. And then eventually I ended up moving here when I was, just going from 9 to 10. So I did spend all of my childhood in Kolkata, which is why I still call it home. It was probably like a very good childhood, I want to say. I'd see people say they have a lot of like vivid cooking memories and things from their childhood, especially chefs and stuff that I know, but I don't think I do. I just know I ate very well. And that's all the memories that I have. I loved living in Kolkata. I grew up mainly with my grandparents because my dad at the time was doing his medical exams to be a doctor in the UK. My mom worked full time in India. So my kind of a lot of my food habits and food rituals that I hone in on now, probably more akin to like my grandparents than my parents. Obviously, my mom shaped a lot of it as well, but my initial childhood bits are definitely from my grandparents. Mm. And yeah, then I moved here just around the age of 10, had a little baby brother when I was 10. He's grown up entirely here, so he's, funnily enough, like a lot less Bengali than me, obviously, because to him, Kolkata is like a holiday place as opposed to, you know, a home. Mm. And for me, it's still home. Like when I say I'm going to India, I mean I'm going home. Mm. I never see it as a holiday place, which sometimes I wish I did because it would make going and coming back a lot easier. I'm pretty famously known for like spending the entire flight on the way back crying. Every time. I know. It's not changed since I was little. Yeah. So I think I have some like weird PTSD with this.
Yeah.
But yeah, I loved living there. I still really enjoy living there, although I don't know if I'd live there full time. And what else did you ask?
What do you work in?
So I'm a chef, not a trained chef. I did something completely different at university and then moved myself into a career that I didn't even know was a career. Mm. And I still feel weird calling myself a chef. I struggle like just being like, yeah, I'm a chef when people ask me, because I always think of myself as just a cook and just very passionate about food first before I am anything else. And I host supper clubs. I've been doing it for nearly 5 years now. Mm. It's about to be 5 years towards the end of this year. And I cook freelance in a lot of places now. I've worked in, oh gosh, so many things. I have to tweak my CV depending on who I'm sending it to, because I've had so many random different jobs. Mm. But a lot of that was figuring out what I wanted to do. Mm. So until, I would say till very recently, like around COVID time, I didn't know what I wanted to do really. Like I like doing lots of different things. I've always loved cooking since I think I can remember. Or like eating at least and then being associated with food. Mm. Obviously, I couldn't cook when I was like a toddler. But I think I've always loved being creative, actually, is probably what I should say.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've always been creative in some way or form. And then I think now I've honed in on what I'm the most creative about and just want to keep getting better at it. I want to feed the world, basically. That's my aim.
You're like, you're well on your way to do that.
Yeah. I feel like I've been saying this a lot recently, but I'm like a compulsive feeder. Like I hate not being able to feed people.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. It's fascinating to me because I'm actually not a very avid cook and I'm trying to be, and I love to eat as well. Mm-hmm. But I feel like loving to eat doesn't always translate into being a very avid cook. You end up cooking good food when you do cook, I guess.
But, yeah.
But yeah, I wanted to ask you, what was your very first memory that you have maybe of eating or being associated around cooking in the kitchen?
So I feel like a lot of people will identify with this, that when you grow up in a South Asian household, especially like, you know, second generation one, which is what I am, maybe first slash second generation one, you don't really go into the kitchen and help your mum cook. It's just not really a thing. Like, my mum would always be cooking by herself.
Mm.
So I never really cooked when I was at home. Mm. As I think it's pretty normal for all of us. Like, I'm sure you also, like, maybe identify with the same thing. Like, you don't stand with your mum while she cooks.
Mm.
You might help her do, like, you know, dishwasher unloading or something, but you're not, like, involved in the cooking process.
Yeah.
So my first cooking memory, honestly, is when I went to university and I really was craving dal because I hadn't had it for like a few weeks and I wanted to make dal and I couldn't because I think, again, growing up as we do, our parents almost try and remove us from cooking a little bit because it's just seen as a necessity as opposed to like something you need to learn how to do. Mm. And so I didn't know how to make dal and I made a terrible thing that I called dal and I ate it and I was really sad and I was like, why don't I know how to do this?
Yeah.
An eating experience, we'll take it right back. My mum has told me repeatedly, so when I was a baby, I loved eating bitter food, which is very odd for a baby.
What, like karela?
Yeah, I loved it. I loved neem, karela. Mm. We had a neem leaf tree in our house and I used to chew the leaves from it.
Wow.
So everyone found that very odd because babies aren't supposed to like bitter things. But I do remember loving bitter from a very young age. And I think actually that's something that really helps me cook, that my flavor palette and my sense of smell, especially, like I remember the smell of these neem leaves so well. Mm. It's very strong. So I can eat something or smell something and know how it's made.
Mm.
I can't explain it any more than that, but the neem leaf smell will forever be etched in my brain.
It's just something that comes to you naturally, I guess.
Right? Yeah, I think it is like an instinct that's just there. Mm. And then, you know, when you practice it more and more, then it becomes stronger.
I want to take it to the name of your brand, which is Smoke and Lime.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about where that came from, because I think that ties in a little bit with
your... A little bit. you know, I have been asked this before by people who come to the supper club. It was a very random name. So when I named the brand, firstly, I didn't know this was going to be my full-time thing.
Mm.
It was just like, let's see if I like... Oh, God. It was just like, let's see if I like doing supper clubs.
Mm.
I knew what supper clubs were at this point. So this was while I was working in hospitality already.
Mm.
But the name was very random. Like I was kind of like, oh, I really always like smoky food and I love cooking on fire. So smoke. And then I knew I wanted two words. And then lime was just the next favorite ingredient of mine. Like lime is in all of my food. Mm. So there's actually no story beyond that. I just like the two words. And I was like, well, that's going to be it. I did not know that that was going to then become like actually like the brand name.
Mm.
I don't know if I'll also keep it forever. Like I love it for now, but I would eventually like to move the brand name to just be my name at some point. I don't know if I want to be known by another word.
Mm.
But for now, I really love it. And I feel like it suits the supper clubs really well.
Absolutely. I think it also suits your personality really well.
Yay.
Like really enjoying limey things. I'm a huge lime fan myself. Yeah. I think it's the one ingredient I will always make sure my fridge has, even if there's absolutely nothing else in there.
Yeah.
and I just make like a lot of like nimbubani. It's like my favorite thing in the world.
So good.
So yeah, I really, maybe that's also why I enjoy your supper clubs a lot, because the kind of flavors that you like to use are more like umami and, you know, salty and limey and sour.
Chatpata.
Yeah,
that's it. Chatpata, that's the word.
Yeah. And I remember the first thing I ate in your first ever supper club that I attended, I was like, oh my God, she's like nailed it. This is exactly like the level I want. Probably, yeah, a lot of salt. I don't know if I could eat it every day, but I actually wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because I know we'll get into it.
Yeah.
In a bit, but do you feel like that's kind of the amount of masala you would put into your cooking, like if you were to just cook for yourself?
The supper clubs came about because I always loved hosting and feeding friends.
Mm.
But the things I cook in the supper clubs are things I like eating myself. Mm. Like, so I've never designed a menu that I wouldn't want to sit down and eat. Mm.
Love that.
But yeah, everything I cook is very strong. Yeah. Obviously, I'm not eating an 8-course meal every day. but I think it's just the flavors that I am used to. And well, luckily enough, my husband is also used to. Mm. But yeah, but again, if we're talking about, you know, amounts of things, it's not overdoing it. It's just what is in that kind of portion. And also, this is a really key thing, and I actually do want to mention this. When you're satiated and satisfied with a mouthful of food, you actually end up eating a bit less.
Mm.
If you are eating food that isn't as satisfactory, actually you'll end up eating a lot more because you're not full.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of fullness and the feeling of fullness and being like content comes from like how satisfied you are.
Mm.
So yeah, for me, it's like everything has to be very punchy. Mm. Not because I want to eat less or anything, but every mouthful needs to be like, you know, it needs to hit every single note. And I try and do that with every dish in any supper club or any event that I'm doing. I want people to like kind of go away thinking about like home food, but also thinking about, oh, this is new and exciting.
Yeah.
There's the two things I want like to just meet in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think try is probably an understatement because I do think you're achieving it with your food that you cook. And I don't know, I have yet to taste a dish that you've made that I've not found like, wow, like really, really yummy. So
me too, honestly. me too, because I think I have really high standards myself. So like when I don't think I often make things that I don't like eating at all. In fact, very rarely.
Mm.
Maybe once in the last year I've made something and I'm like, oh, I don't like it.
Mm.
But because I have very high standards for what I eat and I feel like each meal is so sacred to me, everything just always has to taste good. Like I don't like having mediocre meals because I feel like it's a waste of half of my day. Yeah. Okay. So like, even if it is like, I don't know, a shop bought sandwich or something, I'm that person who has like my homemade sauce in my bag and I'll put it on there and then it elevates it to like level 100.
I love that.
So yeah, I am that person.
You said you grew up in Kolkata or spent quite a few years in there when you were a kid. I know that Kolkata is very known for its street food and it's something that you share a lot as well on your platform. And I wanted to know, what is it about that street food and that relationship you have with that street food that has now translated into the cooking that you do now and the food that you create?
Kolkata obviously has such an incredible history, right? Like it used to be at some point like one of the richest areas of the world. So people migrated there and with that came their food. So actually I have gone to a lot of other cities in India. I don't want to say I've like done India, but I've seen a lot of India. The difference I find with being in Kolkata is that there's an amalgamation of different cultures within India and also away from India.
Mm.
So with that comes all the food that those people brought over to Kolkata, right? So in Kolkata, you can not only get fantastic Bengali street food, but you can also get phenomenal like Maharashtrian street food or Tamil Nadu street food or yeah, things from lots of different parts of India, which I don't think happens very often in other parts of India. Like you get very good food from that region.
Mm.
And you'll know this, but like all regions of India have very, very different food, right? Very different spicing, very different stories and all of that. So Kolkata is a really good hub for that.
Mm.
And also there's a lot of very interesting chefs there that love creating. For me, what translates into my food with that, and because I go so often, is the creativity in Kolkata. Like people are not scared to like add their own flair or their own twist to stuff. And I find that very interesting. Like it's almost encouraged that you have your thing, which I find, you know, especially with Western like cooking, that's kind of not really encouraged. Like you stick to something, this is the way you do something.
Yeah.
Whereas in Bengal, and I'm sure other parts of India as well, it's encouraged that, you know, my mum makes something really well, but my auntie also makes it really well, but they're both dishes, they'll have the same name, but they'll be completely different.
Right.
It's encouraged to like show off your creative flair, even amongst like households and then obviously street food and restaurants. So there'll be like papri chaat stalls, let's say, you know, 20 meters from each other. but they'll have their differences. It's not like one thing that you get everywhere. Like someone will have more tamarind, or someone will have more lime. Someone will add more like red chili. Mm. So I like that. And I like bringing that to the supper clubs because I like almost like, even when people come to my house to eat at supper clubs, which is a, you know, set menu most of the time, I like that there's differences between this week and next week or today and tomorrow, depending on when I'm doing an event, because it's my home and it's my creativity. I don't like that it's like a boxed thing.
Yeah.
So I say this to guests sometimes. I'm like, if you come to eat the same menu, maybe in a month's time, I might have changed something. And that's like what I want to show off. I don't want it to be like, oh, every time you come, you get the same exact dish. Mm. And I think that's my biggest teaching from being in Cork. They're like, it's okay to like be different and like do your own things with your food, depending on your mood and your like creativity at that time. Mm. Yeah.
What's your favorite street food dish?
Oh, puchka, like hands down. Yeah. I dream about puchka like often enough. Like some days here, I'll wake up and be like, oh, I just wish I had puchka today, but I have to make it for myself.
I know what puchka is, but do you want to explain to everybody?
Yeah. So puchka is, I mean, it has lots of other names, pani puri, golgappa, but it's basically a semolina wheat shell. It's very thin. It's like round. It's hollow inside. And then you poke a hole in it. Add a filling in Kolkata has to be potato. There is no other filling apart from potato. And it's usually very spicy, salty. And then you dunk it in this tamarind water and the water's very limey. Sour is the main flavor note. And then you pop it in your mouth and it bursts and it's like the most happy thing ever. It's amazing.
It's like the best kind of shot.
I know. It's amazing. They've started doing alcoholic puchka now in
How
India.
How do you feel about that?
I don't know if I'd want...
I don't know.
I'd try one, but I don't know if I'd want like repeated alcoholic puchka. Like it'd be a bit much.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also it has strong enough flavors anyway. Yeah.
That's where I feel like fusion can be really amazing sometimes. And other times it can be a little bit like, okay, that's a gimmick.
I mean, any food person ever will tell you this, but everyone hates the word fusion. Like I've not met a single person who's in the cooking world who likes the word fusion because fusion is... Maybe at some point it was good, but it's got this negative connotation now where it's like people think it's like, you know, almost tying this thing and this thing or something like that. But actually what most people, especially in the supper club world, do is bring their own personalities to their food.
Right.
So it's not really fusion. It's just showing off your own creativity. Mm. And also, you know, obviously using your background and wherever you come from and where you're going, maybe.
I remember that.
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
So. You mentioned university.
Yep.
And I saw that you studied health economics.
Yeah.
What spurred you to choose that career and what spurred you to not pursue, I guess, to choose that degree but not pursue the career?
Okay. So I did a course in health economics in my undergrad, which was economics. And I really liked it because it was a lot of global health, nutrition. I'm very interested in that still. Health economics as a degree, like as a master's, I actually loved my degree. I thought it was really interesting. It was very hard to do a master's in it because there was a lot of actually medical people that came in to do that side of things. So it was a lot more sciencey than I had expected. Mm-hmm. But the careers that health economics led to, especially for someone who's, I didn't take any breaks in my like education, basically. So I went, you know, school, university, masters. It led to very not creative jobs, if that makes sense. So it was very like you start as an analyst in a firm and you work your way up, which I did. But I think at this point, I was already kind of dabbling in the food world a little bit. I was helping out in a couple of restaurants, just getting a bit of experience. God knows for what, because I knew I didn't, like, I didn't know I wanted to do food at the time. And I was also helping Asma Khan run her supper club, so I knew what supper clubs were. But the jobs health economics as a degree led to at the kind of lower end of the spectrum, it just wasn't suited for my personality, basically. Mm-hmm. And I found it really challenging to go to work. Because, I mean, again, as you all know, like, when you start off in any sort of office-y based role, regardless of what it is, I think like a lot of your time is spent like doing emails and spreadsheets and PowerPoints. And it's pretty normal and people are obviously very good at that. I was just in like this downward spiral of depression. And all I would look forward to is my dinner when I got home, which I would be making. So it just wasn't really for me. And I'm really glad I figured that out when I was like 24.
Right.
Because I didn't have any guidance at the time. I could have just continued doing what I was doing.
What made you get out of it?
So I was in, actually, do you remember the Beast from the East? No. You know that crazy snowstorm situation that happened?
Yes,
I do. Do you remember what I'm talking about? Yeah. Okay. So at that time, I joined a new job. Mm-hmm. And this was after a couple of months of being unemployed from another corporate job because they were like shifting bases or something. And I applied for this job. This job was literally like an hour and 20 minutes commute. It was on the other side of London to where I was living.
Yeah.
And I had to travel through this like snow and like horrible cold weather. And the only thing I would look forward to in this job was making lunches for my colleagues. And at this point, I'd start, like, I used to take in my own lunch every day. And everyone would be like, what is this? What is this? So I'd be like, do you want lunch tomorrow? So I started charging £5 for, like, my lunch boxes.
Okay.
Right. And I got to a stage where these orders got a bit ridiculous. Like, I had, like, 25 orders. Yeah. Obviously, I couldn't carry this to work.
Yeah.
And coupled with that, I was hating my actual job. So all I would look forward to is this like lunch situation that I'd set up for myself. And then I think I just came home one day and was like, I'm going to just start applying for hospitality jobs because I just don't think this is sustainable. So this particular job, I was in it for 1 month exactly. I gave my notice in. I didn't even have a notice period because I just got into this company. And I was like, right, I'm leaving. And they were like, what, you know, obviously what's going on, because they had no idea. And I said, look, I'm just changing my career because I can't really do this. And I think I did get very lucky in that I ended up, when I left, I was offered a salaried job in a Michelin star restaurant, which is very lucky. But I think because they saw my CV, my education, they probably relied on that a little bit and then gave me this job.
Which restaurant was it?
It was Jamavar in Mayfair. That was my first hospitality job, like actual paid job. But they took a chance on me. It wasn't in the kitchen. It was front of house, like as a hostess. And it was just really good exposure into the hospitality world as like a first step in. And then, yeah, like I think experience wise, you know, if you've started in like a really big Michelin restaurant, which is doing 200, 300 covers a day, it just opens your eyes up to like everything that's going on in London and the hospitality scene quite quickly. And I was very receptive at the time into being like, I don't know what I want to do, so I'm just going to be really open and have a little feeler. But, you know, so to condense the question down, the weather was what made me change my mind. I was like, I cannot do this. I can't go to office in this weather. So I need to do something else.
Totally fair. Totally fair. I've had many a day where I've felt that way and it's not pushed me yet.
One day.
One day. Right. So we've talked quite a bit about Smoke and Lime and your supper clubs. I want to understand a little bit about how they actually came about. So you mentioned that you had been doing a few different jobs and you'd worked front of house. Like what? At what point did you decide, I want to start a supper club?
To be honest, the first time I helped Asma Khan at one of her supper clubs, I was like, wow, this is cool. Like she gets to feed people her food, not in a restaurant sense, because restaurants are very different to supper clubs, like as a kind of formula, team, like everything's different.
How so?
Supper clubs are typically headed up by one person and their food, and almost like a showcase of their personality. Restaurants involve a whole team of people. So it's almost like having, I don't know, like a very small company versus like a corporate firm.
Right.
So restaurants are like, you know, it involves like front of house, back of house, bartenders. It's a big thing and it's a big operation. So it's not reliant on like an individual as such, but supper clubs are. And I think that's what attracted me. Like seeing her, like, you know, bring out her biryani and speaking to a whole room of guests that were all looking at her and understanding her story and eating her food and, like, you know, kind of this joy that spread through the room. I think I'm getting goosebumps as I talk about this, but I think the first time I helped her do a supper club, I was like, oh, I'd like to do this someday. And then I think within a year of that, I had my first supper club and she was a guest. So, yeah, it was like a pretty quick turnaround in wanting to do it and then doing it. I got a lot of really good support from my boss at the time, who ran Dum Biryani House in Soho. And then we also worked on another restaurant, both of which sadly have shut due to COVID. But he was super supportive because he also had done supper clubs and then moved into the restaurant world. Yeah, and I think the first time I hosted my own, when people were leaving, I was like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. Because it did not feel like work. It was just like, oh, it's just like filled my heart up. And that's it. It was like, you know that like state of flow?
Yeah.
It was that. And I still have that. Like when I do supper clubs, I'm in like the zone that I can't explain. And I know I'm being like my best self when I'm doing that. So I had that the first time I did it. And I remember when people were walking out the door, I said to Rigel, who's my husband, that I was like, this is what I'm going to do. And then now it's nearly five years after that.
An amazing moment.
Yeah.
To realize that there is something that gives you that much euphoria.
Yeah. It's like, it's still, every time I do a supper club, I have an adrenaline high. Like it takes me so long to get to sleep afterwards because I'm on this like high of like, I don't know, being to the best party ever.
I'm interested in knowing how the cooking process is different in restaurants versus in supper clubs and whether you ever considered actually being a chef in a restaurant.
It's very different. Restaurants, again, like I said, it involves like a whole kind of like, it's almost like an orchestra versus like a solo performer. That's how I would summarize it. So a restaurant cannot function unless everyone's kind of on the same page.
Okay.
It's not just like the head chef is cooking. There's line cooks, there's kitchen porters who are like washing the dishes. There's the sous chef, and it's a whole like kind of, yeah, orchestra. That's the best way I can explain it. Supper clubs are very reliant on most of the people I know doing supper clubs, it's just them. Maybe one other person if it's like a slightly bigger supper club, but it is that person's vision. It happens in some restaurants where you have obviously, you know, like a celebrity chef heading it up and it's their food and their story. But even then, they need to train all the other people to present what they're thinking onto the plates every day, because otherwise that person would be working 24/7, which is not possible. So with any restaurant, you need a team operating and a good enough team so that when people have days off, other people can do the same job. So it's a much more formalized process, I think. Supper clubs are a lot more homely, informal.
Are they more freshly cooked generally as well?
Yeah, I mean, this could be a whole other like topic, but a lot of restaurant food obviously is not cooked on the spot. It's not possible. Like you can't expect the most complicated biryani, you know, in 15 minutes. That's how you expect your food, right? 15, 20 minutes. In supper clubs, it's usually cooked on the day. Yeah, like all the day before, but restaurants often a lot of stuff is batch cooked in very big batches. To take you through like serving hundreds of people. So any supper clubs that I know, that's actually most supper clubs, day before is like the maximum, you know, that you'd be cooking it away from the day of service. And also you're not serving that many people. It's not, people can't just order what they want, right? They're coming knowing that this is what they're getting. So it's a very different approach to food. I don't think I can work in a restaurant like kitchen. I've tried it quite a few times. I've learned so much from doing it. But there's a few things that I've realized. One is that I don't like cooking the same food all the time. It's a pretty big one. And in a restaurant, that is the USP. Like you should be able to go any day of the week and get the same dish, right? So supper clubs aren't really that. It is dependent on the chef, being like, hey, I want to, you know, add some more green chili to my chutney today, or I want to add some more coriander to my chutney today. You can't do that in a restaurant. Mm. That has to be the same exact recipe every single day.
Mm.
So the monotony doesn't suit me.
Mm.
And the working hours, mm-hmm. I mean, it is so antisocial, which is really sad. But I think if you are in the hospitality field, most of the people you will associate with in terms of relationships, friends, they also probably are in that field as well, because mm-hmm. the hours are absolutely horrific.
Mm.
And you're always going to be busy on a Friday, Saturday
mm.
and not be, because that's when people come to eat. So it's inevitable that you will be working.
Mm.
So when I worked in Jamavar, actually Ridgel was away. But when he did come back, like, we never saw each other because I was working 10 o'clock till midnight or 1 a.m. every day.
Wow.
That is just normal. And people don't really raise a question on it, which I think is kind of sad mm-hmm. because you don't have a social life or a personal life most of the time.
Mm.
And I think for me, both of those things are very important, as well as my work, which I love, but I don't want to do my work all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what is your process like when you're preparing for a supper club?
Oh, gosh. My process is actually very backwards. I've said this to so many people, especially chef friends, who are like, huh? I don't practice my dishes. My menus are usually written on a random morning where I'm having some tea. And I'm just like, hey, I've got all these ideas. So I don't like formalizing the process. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have lots of dishes backed up. Sometimes I'll sit down and be like, I need to write a menu for next month. And I will just write it on the spot.
Mm.
It comes from a bank of food ideas that I have in my head. I write stuff down when I eat stuff that I really enjoy. And I have like a weird, like color-coded set of notes on Google that I'm like, this is fun, this is fun. And a lot of it's obviously inspired by things I've eaten.
Okay.
As with anyone cooking, like yeah. that is the way you get inspiration, or traveled. And then I write the menu, and then let's say the menu is written a month before the supper club, then I put the dates out, they get booked, and I cook on the day. I'm very last minute, but organized last minute.
Yeah.
I don't like practicing and prepping, and mm. it's a very, again, like that state of flow. I need to be in that state. Mm. So I'm not doing things the week before or anything. I'll probably think about it. I make a list now because my husband has forced me to make lists, but I am a very organized person in my day-to-day life. But when it comes to cooking, my brain does all the work, and I can't even write most of it down. Mm. Sometimes I have to rein it in a bit and be like, there's too many ideas. But the process is very, very organized in that I shop like, let's say, 2 days before. I love hand shopping for my ingredients. I don't really like ordering stuff because I like feeling my food.
Where do you normally get your ingredients from?
You know, it really depends on what it is. I like going to the regional shops in London,
mm-hmm.
which we're very lucky to have, like a specific Thai shop or a Korean shop or an Indian regional shop, even not even like a generic Indian one.
Yeah.
And I like hand picking ingredients for supper clubs, but I don't, sometimes I do it during, like, through the month. Like, actually, a really good example of this is today I made a betel leaf, which is ban,
mm.
chili oil.
Interesting.
So that was something I've been thinking about for a while. I got betel leaf last week when I went to Bethnal Green to see a friend.
Mm.
I just saw it and I was like, I'm going to make this thing. So I bought it. I made it today. It's obviously going to age a bit and mature because it's chili oil. And I'm going to use it in the supper club end of May.
Mm.
But it's actually not even written on the menu. I just know what dish it's going to go on.
Mm.
And it's going to be a condiment on the menu, because as I've done supper clubs, I've realized I don't like writing very exact menus as well.
Yeah.
Because then people have an expectation of, you know, I'm going to have this particular thing on this dish. So there's a dish that I've written green chili sauce on. Mm. So I'm probably going to use this as my green chili sauce on that, because it's kind of green and it's a chili sauce. So yeah, I've kind of worked out this process where, like, when I can write menus and they can be tweaked a little bit by me, I don't use any of the allergens just to be safe, because then it's uncomplicated for me as a chef. But the process is literally that it's very creative. It's not like I have a set day to do a set thing. I will go shopping, and if I see something like interesting as an ingredient, I'll buy it, experiment with it, and then put it into a supper club menu.
Mm.
And then on the lead up to it, usually the day before is when I do all my kind of more boring prep work, like cutting things or like organizing my crockery and tables and all of that.
Mm.
And then on the day is when I cook all the food. Mm. And then it's served in the evening. And then anything that's kind of going to be cooked fresh, like greens or like herbs, like anything like that, I do it as I'm serving people. Mm. So it is like people get to see exactly what's going on.
Mm.
There's not a lot of like, I'm using something that I made last week.
No, and yeah. And you do kind of, you can tell because you're sort of still kind of cooking and assembling, and we can
exactly see you do it, yeah, in
the supper club. So.
And I really like that. I think with supper clubs, that is in a way a little bit, I think it's going to be the way people eat in maybe the coming future.
Mm.
Because it gives you that sense of home where like someone's cooking and assembling and you see the ingredients and it's very transparent.
Yeah.
And you get to eat this fresh food. Mm. Which sometimes like in a restaurant setting, although yeah, restaurants are amazing. I go and eat at restaurants all the time, but sometimes it can be like, oh, where's this coming from?
Mm.
Especially with bigger restaurants because, yeah, of course they have to prep it in advance. Like sometimes I've had friends who've been so surprised that like, no names named, but like massive restaurants, they'll obviously batch make their sauces in like tons and, you know, of quantity, but they have to, like, of course, like, otherwise it won't be standardized. If one chef is sitting there making the tomato sauce, like, to service, it's going to be different every time they make it.
Yeah.
So you have to almost, like, know that that is what's going on. Mm. And then you have to be okay with it. And it's fine. It's tasty anyway.
Mm.
But when you come to, like, a supper club or go to a private chef, you don't get that because they're cooking for you for that event.
Mm.
And they don't want tons of leftovers because you might not have another event for a while.
Speaking of leftovers, I know you use a lot of like the remaining bits of the food and like ingredients, and I know you believe in no waste. Tell me where that sort of passion of promoting no waste came from, because I've never seen any other chef do that, like literally use peel and make like a curry.
Yeah. So I know some other chefs that do like try and incorporate that. Especially like chefs who work on a small scale, like, you know, little cafes and stuff. People do try and do that. For me, it comes from just how I grew up. Mm. My home in Kolkata doesn't have a bin. Like, honestly, it doesn't have a bin. The kitchen has this like tiny newspaper bag and it gets full very easily, obviously. So the only things that would go in that would be like onion peels or something.
Mm.
But everything we ate with went into our food. And it's just how I've always eaten. I don't know any different. Mm. I've only recently started putting that into my branding and my, let's say, like, you know, social media. Mm. But it's something I've always done. I've done it since I started supper clubs. Mm. I think my actual forte is like opening the fridge and being like, what do I need to do today with stuff that's in the fridge? And I think it's a real skill that I've developed.
Yeah.
But it comes entirely from like my grandma, my mum. Everyone in my family. Mm. My mum can make like, you know, a dal from like 15 days ago taste like it's been made right then because she'll add a fresh tempering with some fresh vegetables.
Mm.
So it's kind of like the skill that I almost want to teach people. And you've come to a cooking lesson, so you've seen the process a little bit behind it.
Yeah.
But it's a skill to be able to open your fridge or your cupboards and be like, this is what I've got. I'm going to make the most of it. And I don't need to go buy lots of new things. Mm. And the no waste thing, I think I've been really fortunate in Australia. I worked in a cafe that was no carbon footprint for a while. And I learned so much from them. Mm. Even though I was already kind of cooking like that at home, it was about learning how to formalize that a little bit and being even more creative with it because they were just phenomenal at the food they made. And it was vegan, but it wasn't like pretentious vegan.
Yeah.
It was just a fantastic vegan cafe that made very creative food with all the ends and peels and seeds and ends of vegetables.
Mm.
So I learned a lot from them. And I think since that experience, it's been even more interesting to me to use everything that I've got.
Love that.
And I think you can always be creative with it. You just got to think outside the box. I think often what happens when people cook, especially if it's like, you know, a chore at the end of your day, you've come back from a busy day of work, is you end up being kind of like almost boxed with what food you make.
Mm.
Like you'll make what you're comfortable with. And if you don't have those things, you might not make it or you might get takeaway. But if you really like switch on the creative side of your brain, there's so much you can do. And I think people can do it. They just like are preoccupied with other things, whereas I'm only thinking about that.
Yeah.
So I'll open the fridge and be like, okay, this is the oldest stuff. This is what I can make today.
Mm.
And we'll make a whole new dish. So I made this like cabbage heart fry thing yesterday with the, you know, the stems of the cabbage.
Mm.
And I just fried it in some pancetta fat.
Mm.
And it honestly tasted like the best Hasselbeck potatoes, but it wasn't. Obviously, it was the stems of the cabbage.
Wow.
But it's just thinking like, oh yeah, this is cool. Like it's still edible. Mm. Let's use it in some other way. Mm. And with the supper clubs, like at the moment, I'm so focused to just not use the bin.
Mm.
Don't open the bin during the entire prep process. So even with onions and garlics, I'm using everything in them. And no one bats an eyelid. Everyone eats it really happily.
Yeah. You wouldn't know, right?
No, you don't really know. The thing is with, especially with vegetables, everything is edible. Like the whole thing is edible.
Mm.
You've just got to find a way to use it. And I think I'm so lucky that I grew up with very strong female characters in my house who did that and believed in that. So I've just got that in my ethos, like quite naturally, which yeah, I'm very fortunate to have.
Mm.
Yeah.
So the journey of an entrepreneur, you've said, is quite turbulent or has been. What have some of the challenges been that you've overcome doing Smoke and Lime by yourself, and especially around your finances? Do you think it's feasible for anyone to do?
You've got to be used to the volatility of it.
Mm.
I think that's my main learning. I'm still getting used to it. I don't think it's that feasible, actually, if I'm being very honest. However, the current state of mind or like growth that I'm in, I don't want to do another job like full time. I am working other jobs like freelancing because, again, London is such an expensive city to live in.
Yeah.
And if you want to maintain even like a pretty basic lifestyle, you have to earn a lot of money. Especially now. So I freelance on the side. I do other projects. I do private chefing, which is, you know, when people book me like separately away from supper clubs. But what I found working in a full-time job, as well as doing supper clubs, as well as doing freelance bits, was that I just had no time to actually think about my creativity. Because you know that you're getting a salary, so you can kind of, like, your brain becomes a little bit lazy, I guess, because you're like, yes, of course I'm going to get this money at the end of the month. And then secondly, you just don't have the time. Like, you come back home, and I'm probably a bit of an anomaly. Like, I look forward to coming back home and then cooking and, like, doing the whole thing from scratch. But it is also easy to not do that and then forget about it.
Yeah.
And then just do supper clubs on default. And I think that's what I realized was happening with me, that I was putting out supper club menus. They were filling out and they were really good events, but mentally I was kind of like, okay, well, I'm doing other things as well. This isn't my primary focus. So I don't know how feasible it is. Firstly, I have a very supportive partner.
Yeah.
Who happens to have a very stable job, thank God. And I think that really does help. Like, honestly speaking, and I've spoken to him about this, like, if it was just me and I was single, I think I would have had to have another full-time job.
Yeah.
There's no way I could deal with the volatility living in London.
Mm.
But it helps having a very stable partner with a very stable salary who can, in case things don't work out every month, can help.
Mm.
It's nice knowing that at the back of my mind. I am very fiercely independent and I started earning from my university days. So I love paying for my own things and having my own money. So sometimes the volatility really gets to me.
Yeah.
Because some months are incredible. Like this month, amazing work. But it's not like that every single month. So there's some months where I don't really have that much to do and I'm just on social media, just creating stuff, but I don't have actual people to be feeding.
Mm.
So I'm kind of getting used to that. Still an upward, like, battle. I do think that if you have that backing in whatever way, like wealth or like another job or whatever, it helps.
Yeah.
So when I started Supper Clubs, I had a full-time job and I was doing another side job. So it's not, people don't do Supper Clubs to get rich, basically, is what I want to say. It's a passion project. And I love that I do them, but if I wanted to get rich, I wouldn't be doing this, basically.
What would be your future aspirations for Smoke and Lime and for your career trajectory?
You know, I question this a lot myself. I don't know what success looks like for me. Like, I often find myself questioning it. I love having a separate life away from my creativity as well. So opening a restaurant is a no-no, at least for now, because I've seen owners and creative people in that industry and how they just completely like burn out because it is a business and then you have that pressure and it's financial.
Yeah.
So I think something, I would love to have a space, like a cafe or maybe not even a cafe, but just a community space where I can create and people can come and hang out, or we can showcase movies, or we can have arts exhibitions. And just almost like make it like a hub for people to come in a community. That's what I would really like.
Yeah.
In a place like London, I don't know how feasible that is because the rent for everything is like through the roof.
Yeah.
And like I said, I don't want to be working 24/7 despite how much I love my job. So ultimately, I think what it's looking like is that I would just like the predictability of booking out supper clubs every month. And just that to be steady. And I'd like to teach cooking more than I do now. And I'd like to teach the ethos of what I do. Instead of like, you know, here's a recipe, cook this. Just the technique of how to just look after your own meals and like cook for yourself and be happy with what you're eating. So I'd like to teach that a bit more, and then coupled with supper clubs and then lots of downtime and traveling to India a lot. Yeah.
Getting inspired.
I really think like with people in this like food world, like the inspiration is actually half the job because even now at the moment, I haven't been away for a little while and I'm like itching to like go somewhere new or old and just eat new things or even eat things that I've eaten in the past that have inspired me because there's only a certain amount of creativity that can come out from like repeated work. But yeah, I think just a nice space with a little bit of predictability and being able to feed people constantly would be great.
Yeah, and I think you're doing such an amazing job at that because it's, I can only imagine how difficult it must be, even mentally, when you have the down.
It's pretty exhausting. Yeah, I feel like my brain is constantly on. In fact, actually, since I've become self-employed, I thought I would have lots of time, which I do in actual terms. But I find it so hard to not work. Like, I'm constantly, like, thinking about what I'm doing next. It's really hard to switch off and be like, okay, today I don't do anything to do with my business. I just have a meal and take no photos of it. Yeah. It's really hard. It's really hard to switch off.
Sounds like a very common theme among business owners.
Yeah, it's just, like, how do you tell yourself, like, or if someone messages me and I'm on, you know, whatever holiday situation or even a weekend, I have to reply because it's my business. Like, I'm the one looking after it. So I can't be like, okay, I'm going to reply on Monday morning. You know, so I find in social situations, especially with like my relationship or like friends, like sometimes that can be a bit tricky because I feel like I am constantly working away. And the other thing is, I think I kind of wanted to say this with your last question that I think I, probably a bit odd in saying this and a bit weird, but I don't think I have like crazy massive dreams and I'm actually okay with that.
Yeah.
I don't want to have like the next massive chain of restaurants or like the next big it cafe. I just want people to like my food and come and eat it and become regular customer in whatever form that is, even if it means coming to my house to hang out with me. And I think the thing I love most is creating like a community space, like of people that I can just talk to and like that I know really well. And again, in London, that's really hard because people are so busy all the time.
It's very true.
But this is again like kind of going back to the way of living in Kolkata. Like there's this word we have called adda, and I've been trying to build that more into my life. Adda just means to sit back and discuss whatever it is. There has to be no topic, but you have chai and you have adda, and it's a thing in Kolkata. Like people do it every single evening. And I want to kind of bring that into my work somehow. And I want supper clothes to be that space where people can just come and hang out and eat and then discuss whatever they want to discuss. Like it could be food, it could be whatever you want. but I feel like spaces like that are lacking in big cities.
And I think you're creating that adda for yourself.
Yeah, I love that. I always, you know, people don't take me seriously, like including all my friends included, my closest ones. I'm always like the door to my house is open. Like you can turn up anytime.
Mm.
I love just sitting down and chatting to people.
Love that.
And I feel like, especially like the way we grew up and like, you know, we moved to the big cities. I did that as well. Like you kind of get lost in like meeting people and like doing things every day.
Yeah.
And I love bringing that back to just be like, hey, come over. Let's sit on the sofa and like vegetate a little bit. And then I'll make some food because I love cooking.
Love the slow life.
Yeah. Like obviously dotted with, you know, doing work and doing other things. But I think the slow life is the one for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Shohini, what do you have strong game in?
Oh, gosh. What does this question mean, by the way? You can obviously edit this out. But I read it and I was like,
It just means, what do you like being known for? Can be anything. Feeding people?
Yeah, I think I have strong game in hosting and feeding and making a home for someone.
Mm.
I think that's what I want to have a strong game in. I don't know if I do.
I think you do.
Yeah, definitely. I just like making a cozy space, providing food, and a place where you can just relax.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on today. It was lovely talking to you.
I feel like I was rambling so much.
Absolutely not. No.
But thank you for having me.
Your brain is like a big, creative, you know, colorful space, and I can tell.
It's very colorful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not good colors all the time.
Not always.
Not always.
But that is the life of a creative, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we move on.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me. I hope you keep doing this.
Oh, thank you.
And having on all the people so I can listen to all of their conversations as well.
Thank you, Shohini.
Yeah.
Well, I hope people book onto your supper clubs come and try your food, because trust me, it does taste amazing.
Thank you. I do feel like that needs to be said, though, because I feel like with social media, like even I see so much, you know, like the videos and the plating and everything. And then sometimes even I'm like, I wonder if this tastes good, because it's a whole different skill set to like film food and take photos of food.
Absolutely.
And then to feed people.
Needs to taste good.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I have so much I have so much self-doubt a lot of the time, actually. Like, I'd say 50% of my month is a bit of self-doubt.
Mm.
And Rigel is the one to thank for this. He's always like, yes, but people come through your door.
Absolutely.
Sit on your chairs and eat your food and they walk away happy. Mm. And I'm like, yeah, that's what I have to remember, because social media can really cloud that sometimes, where I'm like, I'm not producing the best content.
Okay,
but I know people will come and eat my food, and honestly the end of supper clubs, the joy in the room, it's the best feeling in the world, because I know I can bring that to people. And when people leave, every single person I'm pretty sure has said, I can't wait to go home and like have a good sleep. And I'm like, to me that's like, I've won. In whatever it is that I'm doing, I've won, because if someone can go home and have a relaxed sleep, great. I've done them some good.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Doing what you do. And I wish you all the success.
Thank you so much. We'll continue chatting.